Good morning, everyone, and welcome to the first discussion panel from the Advocacy Task Force of 2024. And I can tell you, with what's been going on in the room moments before, there's a lot of energy in this room today. So you are in for a real treat. We're glad to have you here. Our topic today is, are we dog trainers or teachers? That's what best describes what we do. And I kind of changed the title at the last moment on my notes here to what best describes what we do for our clients. And as I prepare for these, starting from the time we pick the title and kind of add a little pieces here and there, somebody had on Facebook posted an excellent meme, which I shared with the panel, which gave us some ideas, I think, how we can talk about this. But I think what I'm going to start out with is we're going to go through the panel one by one, and in a one or two words, tell a prospective client what you do. And then we're going to revisit that with some more detailed descriptions. But what do you do? And Debbie, thank you for volunteering.
Well, it's going to come anyway, right, Don?
That's right.
I always tell clients, I say hi. I'm glad you reached out. I'm a canine coach,
Two
and what
words.
that
Two
means,
words.
oh, canine coach. Okay,
There we go. Okay, good. That works. Okay.
I
Sandy,
miss
you're
you,
next on my screen. Or Sandra.
Sandy or Sandra. I'm a dog trainer. But can I go? No, is
Two
it
words.
okay?
Or up to three, but no more than three.
I'm a pain-free dog trainer.
Okay. That works. Judy, you're next.
Behavior consultant, since I have to use two words.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, I can't have three.
Beth.
Well, I am absolutely not a dog trainer. I'm a cat behavior consultant.
Okay. Kim.
Dog pro.
Okay. Thank you. And Sam.
I'm a teacher.
Okay. And I'm going to throw mine in here. And I usually tell people I'm a teacher of people. Because
Three words,
that's,
Don. That's three words.
well,
I
I
knew we
remember
could do
for you,
that.
Debbie, I said we could go up to three words. You kind of
Okay.
forced me down that road. So, but yeah, I really consider myself a teacher first. But there's lots and lots of things. And Beth, I'm so glad you're here. Keep us talking about the cat perspective on this too, because it's just, I mean, no. Anybody here ever heard of a cat trainer?
Absolutely.
Well, but not typically. I mean, there aren't many people that deal with cats that call themselves a cat trainer. So
We
I
need
think this is,
more. We do need more.
we do need more
Yes.
cat behavior professionals, just like we need more dog behavior professionals. But I
The
think
best
what's
tool, Don, I just want to say this real quick. The best tool in my toolbox, so to speak, is the cat specialist trainer that I had in my neighborhood or that I had in my town. So
Okay.
if anybody has cat specialist out there, team up with them, man. It's the best
Yeah.
use of your time and the most help you're going to find.
So some of us struggled to do this in two words,
Yeah.
realistically, and I expected that to happen. So what I would like us each to do is to give kind of a summary of what it is you really do in as many words as you would like. Sandra.
So, what I tell my clients is that what I tell my clients is that dog trainers, what I believe dog trainers are, they are interpreters, they are translators, they are mediators. They're very most of the times we are the only ones in the room who actually speaks both languages, who actually understands both languages. So that's why every single time I start with a new client, the very first thing is body language. Body language, body language, body language. This is what your dog is saying. This is what your dog is not saying. The other thing is, I want to tell you, I want to show you what you have, but most importantly, I want to show you what you don't have. You don't have difficult, you don't have alpha, you don't have dominant, you don't have a dog that wakes up and says, okay, what can I do to like annoy my client, my neighbor, my owner today? What can I do to, they don't have agendas. So if we can, if I can summarize in one word, which is really hard for me, right? It is, it's an interpreter. We are interpreters.
Okay. Who wants to go next? Debbie.
I love that, Sandra. I agree with you 100%. And I always tell people that I am there to train the humans, to help them understand their dogs. And you know, so many people, they call you and they say, my dog is so stubborn, or my dog needs to be more, I need obedience, you know, and I always, you know, we hate that word so much. And I talk to them about learning how to look at your dog in front of you and really asking yourself, what does the dog need? What is the dog trying to tell me? Why are we seeing this behavior? And we go from there.
Who wants to go next? Judy?
I tell my clients that what my job is to help them and their pet just have the best life that they can. And I often dispute what normal trainers do because I don't walk in the room and immediately start teaching the dog to sit or down. And in fact, that's not even my list of behaviors that I teach anymore. And I think what we've seen throughout the years is trainers that have these, what is it, 6 or 7 behaviors that every animal should learn. I've pretty much thrown them all out, but they've made it so difficult for people that people actually are looking for some help to have a better life with their dog without having to be so controlling, because that's not natural for most people. So my goal is just to make everybody happy in the easiest, most comfortable way for everyone. And while they're having fun, of course, we have to have fun.
Absolutely. Who wants to go? Beth, then Kim, then it's you, Sam.
So I agree with you, Don, that I'm the teacher of the humans. My goal when I work with clients is to make sure they understand what their cat needs and what their cat is doing and what their cat is asking for, and then help them to find compromises that work for them and work for their cat. So I always tell people, you know, I'm not going to ask you to turn your house over to your cat, but you still need to give your cat what they need. And so it's helping them to understand what the cat needs, how the cat needs to live happily and healthily and well, and what the compromises are that they can reach so that their house is comfortable for them and happy for their cat.
Excellent. Kim?
I like the word dog pro because I think for me, I wear different hats throughout my sessions with a client. So usually when I'm starting with a client, I'm their mediator. And like Sandra said, their translator. And then, you know, there is a place sometimes for the animals learning certain skills. So that's when I might put on the trainer hat. I think we confuse our clients in our industry with the alphabet soup, all the letters that we have after our names and what I call myself and what you call yourself. And, you know, they don't know what they're getting sometimes when they hire us or when they're thinking about hiring us. So I just like to explain it in that I'm going to teach them how to live with their dog in a much better way. And somewhere along the way, they're going to learn some training, a little bit of training with that, but it's mostly about meeting their dog's needs and then also making sure that their needs are met, because like you said, Dawn, teaching the people, they have needs too. Otherwise they wouldn't be hiring us. So it's not just about the dog. It really is a people business.
Mm-hmm. Sam, your turn.
I explain to people that I am a teacher and a guidance counselor. We all remember the days of school, right? Parents all remember their days. Their kids are in school, whatever. But the biggest thing was the guidance counselor was being able to set goals, realistic, reach for dreams. And the dream is for the owners and their dogs that have this great partnership. You know, it's my byline is that you build trust and then you can teach skills so you can change behaviors and enjoy a partnership. And I firmly believe in that. And that's what, to me, what a teacher and a guidance counselor does, whether they're with the human or with an animal, because that's our job. We do have to provide guidance. It's something they don't have. They don't know. We have to teach them the language. There's all these things that go into it, but if a dog is being, if a dog and her person is going to do some type of canine sports, I feel that the word trainer may be more appropriate there. But when we're teaching life skills, whether they're for the people and or their companion animal, that's the difference. We're not training, we're teaching.
I love that.
I have the advantage of, I got to listen to what all of you said, but you know, the way I describe it is I am here to help you and your pet have the best life together possible. That is my number one goal, whether it's a dog or cat. I don't see nearly as many cats as you do, Beth. I probably see 100 dogs for every cat person I help, but that is really my number one goal. And I explain to do that, I'm probably going to need to teach you some things. I'm going to teach you about what your pet needs. I'm going to need to teach you how they communicate and how you can best communicate with them. And I'm going to also teach you about nutrition and other things you probably haven't even thought of that are all part of that healthy, happy pet. And, you know, as I over the years, I've looked at my previous careers and what I've done here, and I've seen always one common theme. And this goes back to something that Sandra said about being an interpreter. I call it being a translator. But, you know, in my previous careers, I translated between sales and marketing and the engineering department, between sales and marketing and clients. And in my last career, sales and marketing and regulatory, or the company and regulatory agencies. But it's really taking two different parties and helping them understand each other. And I think that's why I didn't think of that when I got into this profession, but I think that's why I've been relatively successful at it and why I enjoy doing it so much. Because when you see the light turn on either side, you feel real good about it. I think we've all given some really great examples here, but I'm going to throw another question here at you. Do you think that's what, so who's somebody that refers to us a lot? Veterinarians. Mm-hmm. Do you think that's how they see us? Or do they see us as the people who teach, sit down? And if you teach, sit down and all of this other stuff, you've solved every behavior problem there is known to humankind. Because that's kind of how I think many of them see it. Your thoughts?
I think Kim. It depends. Oh, go ahead, Kim.
I don't think they know what we do for the most part. I think that they know that we know more than them, or that we have the time that they don't have to devote to that family's issue with their pet. But I have found that the majority of veterinarians that I get the opportunity to have conversations with, they're very honed into their lane with the client dog, and they defer to us and they don't ask a lot of questions, of me. So that's what makes me think they don't really know what I do. So I've started sending recaps of this is the training plan and this is what I'm doing. If I have, you know, email communications with vets so that I can educate them at least on what it is that I do, because I don't think that they know.
Debbie.
I was going to say, Kim, that I think it depends on the relationship that you have with your vet. You know, early on, I went into my own vet and I spoke to her about other people that were trainers in the area and what they were doing and why that wasn't helpful. And she was pretty horrified. And now when people come in and they have a prong collar or they have, you know, a shock collar, she actually tells them that they should reach out to me. And then I have another vet who you know, I think it's so important to try and develop that relationship with the veterinarians in your area so you can actually educate them. What's going on? What's going on with people? What's going on with other people? And you know, what we want for our dogs, to, you know, to have that life where they're listened to and understood.
Sandra.
I think it depends on the cases that they send you. You know, it depending on the cases that they send you, you know, if they know more or less what you do. So they send me cases of dogs that are aggressive, you know, or reactive at the vet's office. You know, they usually send me large dogs, and because I'm known to work with large dogs in a pain-free way. So I don't know if they know exactly what I do, but they want the end result that the next time the dog goes there, the dog is behaving a certain way, you know. And then in the meantime, there's all these different things that you will do, you know.
Beth.
It's very different with cats and veterinarians. So veterinarians refer cats to me who have litter box problems and aggression problems that they can't find a medical cause for, or that they think there might be a medical cause with a behavioral component. So I get a lot of those, and cat introductions where people ask their vet advice about cat introductions and the vet doesn't want to go there. And so they refer them to me. So those are the three kinds of vet referrals I get.
Okay. Judy.
I think the best people to help us with vets, and I'm going to tell you, in my area, I don't have the same experience, unfortunately, that Kim has, or probably anybody else. My clients tell the vets what I do.
Exactly.
And that really helps with referrals. But what I have in my area, and I'm going to tell you, I firmly believe it depends on what vet school the vets go to in what I'm saying. Okay. So most of the vets in my area go to Missouri University, and they tend to try to give behavior counseling to all their clients, opposed to calling a trainer or behavior specialist. Mm-hmm. They're going to give them mostly bad advice that they had been given when they first got a dog, you know, 20 years ago or whatnot. So it's really kind of tough, because they really want, in often cases, to have to refer to somebody else. They want to grab all that themselves. So when I have clients, they go into their vet and say, hey, remember last time we were here and I was talking to you about whatever the issue was? Judy came out and fixed the dog, their term, or changed the behavior, and this is what she did. So that's actually a best case scenario for me, because a lot of vets in my area try to do it all, which is sad. They don't have time for that, or they shouldn't have time for that.
I have a question for Beth. How do they know about you? How do vets know about you?
Well, when I started practicing, I went around to the practices in my neighborhood and introduced myself. A lot of them were very skeptical, and I understand that. If a vet gives a referral, they don't, they want to be very careful because their name is attached to that referral. So the first veterinarian practice that really started referring me extensively was the one that I took my own cats to. And they saw how my cats behaved at the vet and started asking me questions about how I got my cats to behave that way. And I reminded them that I was a cat behaviorist, and they started referring me. So that's how that started. The veterinarians in my neighborhood talked to other veterinarians. And then the other thing that happens is that clients have mentioned me to their veterinarian. And those vets then say, oh, can I have her number? I'd like to speak to her. And so that's it. So it grew in a very slow way, which, like I said, I understand vets don't want to attach their name to a recommendation and then it backfires and they look bad too. So it grew in a very slow way, but that's how it's grown.
And that's the best way, right? That's the best way.
I always think the best recommendations are happy clients. Yeah.
Right.
And then exactly. I mean, statistically, the best referral you can get is from a happy client.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Judy.
So I'll tell you what I do, and I still hold this, this offer, I should say. Vets get free training from me, free classes, free in-home visits, whatever they need. And so I work very closely with a lot of vets, and I actually taught a class one time at a vet clinic for other vets to come to and bring your dog, and we're going to learn some things. And it was a breaking point because they were able to see with their own pets how my methods work. And so that's something, if anybody's ever looking to work with more vets, that's just a really good way of doing it to get your name out.
And doing with the staff, you know, like the staff, the techs and all that.
Well, I give everybody that works at the vet clinic free training, you know, and people might think I'm crazy for that, but
no,
I do.
No.
Debbie.
I also not only, you know, free training, but bring your vet techs and your vet's goodies, you know, whenever you can. And they love that. And that's fun. But also the animal control officers, you know, depending on where you are, I know so many different animal control officers in Connecticut, and some are fabulous and some are just, we're just looking for that job and don't care, sadly. But if you can get to know your animal control officer, so the three towns around me, I'm always available, you know, if they get a dog in and they call me and they say, can you come and evaluate this dog for me? And I do that, just like Judy said, you know, free of cost. But then when somebody adopts a dog and they call back the ACO to say, this is going on or this is going on, they say, well, call Debbie. But, you know, I mean, I think all of us here really we genuinely care about the animals. Mm-hmm. So when you go and talk to different professionals, that really shows. And it's so important to get that feeling out there.
I mean, one of the things I've done, well, then we'll get to you, Sam. I just saw that, is a lot of lunch and learns with vets where they're up to it. And, you know, they usually can't afford a lot of time. And since COVID, their time is even more. But free seminars for shelters and rescue groups can work really well. And I've talked about this in some of the other things we've done, but every year they all get a free book from me on either behavior or something pet related that I think is stuff they need to know. And I have to tell you, that has really changed a lot of minds too. I mean, they don't always read it right away, but once they do, I mean, I've had some calls back and it's like, you mean I've been doing it wrong all these years? Yeah. Well, you know, I'm glad you read the book. If you want to set up a time to talk about it, you can talk about it. But all those things work really, really well. Sam.
I think that, I realized it was an advantage, but at the time, I went into this right after I retired as a canine officer. So when I was first starting out, people and vets would say, oh, he's a canine officer, you train canines, whatever. And so they would reach out to me. They didn't realize that I was very lucky in that our training was force-free training. And we were bomb dog handlers, so we weren't, you know, the usual what you see on television. And it was interesting in that I was asked to speak at the local shelter, and the veterinarians there were kind of like, huh? And then also I was associated with Victoria Stillwell. I was associated at that time with the Best Friends Animal Society. So these were things that got me in the door. And then my own vet, which was to this day, it's been going on for 17 years. I go in there for a vet visit and I'm always the last one of the day because afterwards he spends an hour asking me questions about behavior.
That's great.
For me, the downside has been that, I know you probably won't think of it the same way, I get calls from vets all over the state of New Jersey, vets I have never met before. I have no idea where they're at, who they're from, how they even got my name, saying, hey, we understand you deal in moderate to severe behaviors, so we have somebody we'd like to refer to you. And when I get the chance, though, before I take on that referral, I do talk to the vet to say, listen, I just want you to understand how I work. And as somebody said before, everything I do, where there's been a vet referral or someone's working with their vet as well, they get copies of the training plans and all that kind of stuff. But sometimes just having an advantage, you know, of well, you know, you came from this or you're associated with this, does get you a chance to talk to vets, vet professionals of all kinds, rescue groups, whatever, to say, what do you do and why do you do it that way?
That's great, Sam. Mm-hmm.
Sam.
Beth and then Sandra.
I'm so happy you're on this side of the tracks, you know. Like,
I'm not the only, by the way, and just so, I don't know if any of you know, an unbelievable trainer, I mean, terrific trainer out of Rochester, New York, Ada Sims, who was retired Rochester police officer and who was on, as you said, Sandy, this side. But unfortunately, we lost her today.
I'm sorry. Oh,
oops, you froze.
I think we had a disconnection problem there with Sam, too. Hopefully, he'll be able to come back. Sandra, did you have something you wanted to? Somebody else had their hand up before Sam started, or after he started.
Not me. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. So I was going to say that for my vets, part of it I said is that they saw how my cats behaved, but the other thing is, particularly with cats, there are a lot of people who are not doing science-based work, and a lot of what. The way that I got them to feel comfortable referring me was to talk to them about the fact that I do science-based work. And so I attend conferences, and occasionally I attend veterinary conferences because some veterinary conferences have a behavior component. And when I attend veterinary conferences, I pick up cool stuff there and bring it to them. Like, hey, you know, they have this really great stuff that you can use to get, you know, urine tests from a litter box. I can't use this, but I thought you guys might be interested. And then they know I went to a veterinary conference, and they know that I'm serious, that I'm doing continuing education, that I'm doing science-based work. And sometimes I the vets that I have a really close relationship with, I call them up and I say, my clients are asking me about CBD all the time. What should I tell them? What do you guys know? So then they also know that I'm not like going out and pretending that I'm giving vet advice, you know, that kind of thing. And I think the fact that it's very clear to them that I do science-based work and that I'm not overstepping into veterinary stuff is very important.
So I'm going to shift the discussion a little bit. You know, we've all talked about what we think we do and how our clients perceive us. And for those of you that are listeners today, if you want to put something in the chat and then Pam can relate to that, how do you think your clients and the vets in your area perceive you? Because I'm going to suggest, I think most vets, and if I'm wrong, you guys tell me, most vets still see us as teaching sit down, leave it, heal, walk, or come when called, and that's kind of it. And I see Judy nodding her head, which is a sign for me to pick on you. But you know, I think that's what they still perceive we do. And I would even suggest a lot of shelters and rescues feel that way too. How do we go about changing that perception? I mean, I think all of us have done it in our areas, and we've kind of talked about that, but how do we do that as an organization? Really try to get people to recognize we're more than dog trainers.
Are you asking me, Don?
Yeah.
She said, okay. So I honestly, because I'm shaking my head, honestly, we need to just kind of change the process for everyone on this. We need to try in some way to relabel the dog training industry. I don't even know how to word it, but it's education, right? It's teaching people what we do. We need to change what we did in the past or what trainers have been known to be and do. I think we just have to get that mindset change for people.
Gabby?
I think we also have to just reach out and put ourselves out there as much as we can. You know, I did a talk for my town library and during COVID, and they had a cap it at 100 people because that's all they could fit. And it was, people really wanted to hear, you know, they wanted to know. And then you know, if you have a local newspaper, you can reach out and and talk about what you want to say. Like I talked about that we've gone from teaching sit and stay. Like I said, that's not important to me at all. You know, what's important is what feels good to the dog and the human in their relationship. Even, you know, when I did the newspaper talk, I brought up examples. Like a lady called me and said she was so upset that her dog doesn't sit at the end of the sidewalk. I think some of you heard me tell this story before. And I said, do you sit at the end of the sidewalk? You know, every time do you get to the end of the sidewalk, do you sit? And the lady on the telephone got very annoyed with me. But it's one of those things where, you know, why is this important? And of course, she wanted the dog to wait, not go into the traffic. But let's teach wait and let it be the dog's choice. And, you know, it's so cold now. I was out walking with my dog a few days ago, and I saw this person with their dog across the way insisting that the dog sit. It was the same situation. And it's cold. Who wants to sit on the ground when it's cold? And I just, you know, it kind of hurts your heart. So just, I think, reach out to all different venues just to get the word out there. You know, what's important? What's important for them? What's important for relationships?
Hold on there. Judy, I saw your message about Sam. Pam, if you're listening, can you make Sam a co-host again so he can put his camera on, and then to Kim.
As much as I don't want to say it, you know, marketing, like on our websites and what we put on social media, is very important. It's not my strong suit. I'm constantly changing my wording of things because I'm constantly changing. I'm evolving. And the language we use, even the term dog trainer, you know, it's unfortunate that the algorithms and the SEO and the Google stuff of the world is looking for certain terms, you know, to send people to us for the services that we provide. So sometimes people come to us, I think, with an expectation of what we do. And I think it's important that if those Googles get them to us, that when they land there on our website or our social media pages, that it's clear to them that we're different, that we stand out from the person who is going to teach them how to sit at the corner of the sidewalk and, you know, go to their bed when a visitor comes over and that sort of thing.
Sam, go ahead.
Debbie, boy, I'll tell you what, you said that right.
Thanks.
Trying to get people to understand what is truly important. Like, okay, are there certain things we can do that we can teach them to teach their companion animal that might save their life? Sure. Everything else is gravy. Years ago, I had a client who had an Irish wolfhound, one of the most beautiful animals I've ever worked with. And she was so smart, but the woman had an 8-foot fence in her yard, didn't matter. So the Irish wolfhound would jump the fence to chase a deer. Right, no big deal. No matter how many times the dog did this, when she got done chasing a deer, she would walk back home through town. And because of the fact that whenever this woman walked her dog, whenever she came to a corner, she would stop and look both ways because it was a busy town, busy intersections, etc. So the dog, whenever it was done playing with the deer, would walk through town and it would stop at every corner. And it would wait for traffic, and then it would move on its own and go home. And it never got hit, anything else. People in town would always call her up and say, by the way, your dog is here and it's on its way home, et cetera. Mm-hmm. But it came from just, you know, the woman did it just because out of safety when she was walking her dog, and the dog got it. And there was none of this forced, you know, compliance. And another word in our language, in our profession that just drives me nuts. And and Kim, you know, you're saying about the algorithms and the SEOs and all that kind of stuff. I wonder though, even though we are a social media driven society, etc., I wonder how much of that we actually really need when we're putting our name and our services out there. And for new members of the profession, and especially younger members, I understand that. I haven't done any SEO on my site. I totally disregard it. I could care less about it. And I know for some of the professionals in my area who train like that, we do in that, they really don't, other than a website for business purposes, they don't have a social media presence. Because they find that, somebody said before, the word of mouth, mm-hmm. and the fact that they're, yeah. because they're such good teachers and such good educators and such good mediators and translators and interpreters, et cetera, that a lot of those words for what we do don't fit into those algorithms.
No, so, I oh, go ahead. Finish.
No, good, Don.
I really think that's very important. And, you know, I've been doing this for over 28 years. So Facebook, Twitter, none of it existed. I built my business talking to vets, talking to people, being out there every day. Do I use social media now? Yes. And does it bring in some new clients? Yes. But it's that local connection. The other thing too, I think people figure out what your business area, what you want it to be, and that's going to vary for everybody, but then work on that area and get out there and talk to people. And Debbie, you talked about at the library, in the next 2 months, I'm talking to a Rotary Club.
Yes,
and I am talking to a senior group, and I find ways to do this efficiently so I can create one presentation and use it for both. But what I'm talking about is how this profession and how the attitude towards pets has changed in the last 28 years. Right. Because it has really, I consider myself so lucky to have gotten into this profession at this time, because so many things have happened. It's just amazing. But a lot of those things aren't well known yet. And that's sometimes where we can use social media to get the word out about some of those things. But look at things like that. It's that personal connection that is ultimately going to do you more than any connection on Facebook. Sandra, and then Judy.
I use my website and social media to back me up, to be honest, because I hardly ever get anyone from social media or from the website. And then once they come to me, I'm like, look, I exist. And then I send them back there. But going back to things that we do that are differently, what I like to do with my clients or at the vet's office or anything is to show them more than, because I am very big on body language. And there is no better way to show body language than doing nose work. So you get a dog that is incredibly reactive to other dogs, and they think that their dog is like, oh my God, my dog is super aggressive. You get five boxes where I carry in my car, I have in my car five boxes all the time. I bring those five boxes in, and this dog that is 150 pounds cannot go into a box because that box moves. The back legs are all the way stretched out, like Nadia Comaneci, you know? And he's trying to go in, and he cannot. Nobody knows who Nadia Comaneci is, oh my God.
I do.
We do. We do.
Well, no, I mean, I would expect everyone here, but like, a lot of people in the profession probably don't.
So they're stretching out, and I say, you see, your dog cannot go in a box because the box moves. Oh, but they can jump on the couch because it doesn't move. So that is a way that I have to transfer. The dog is afraid. The dog is fearful. And with dogs that are, I'm working with a 100-pound dog, and it's a Ridgeback. Drop that gorgeous. On a 4-foot leash, heel, 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 heel. So what he does is he redirects, and he starts biting her. And biting her. So I went to a park and I put this dog on a 60-foot leash. And I said, you know what? Let's see what he does when he can make a choice. Let's see what he does when he doesn't have to look over his shoulder, you know, what's out there to get me. And this dog did not once reach to the end of the leash, walked beautifully, calmly, never once went back to her. So I think that visual is such a great way to show them, you know, what they have, again, what they have and what they don't have. Does that make sense?
Judy.
So I'm seeing things change in my areas a little bit, probably because, like all of you, I'm out doing presentations, I'm talking to vets, I'm educating people on different ways to teach their dogs. And I'm getting phone calls now from people who say, listen, I want to talk to you about your training method, but before we go any further, I want to let you know, if you tell me I can't sleep with my dog, I'm not going to work with you. And I say, whoa, back up. I'm going to tell you to sleep with your dog because it's a bond building experience, blah, 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 blah. And it's very interesting because I moved from the St. Louis area, a big city, down to a small town of about 10,000 people. And down here, they all think I'm a granola kind of person. Oh, you're all foo-foo. And recently, a Montessori school came in, and now I'm the Montessori dog person. But in reality, they're all doing that already. You know, they're not vocal about sharing popcorn while they're watching a movie with their dog, because they have been taught in the past that that's taboo. So we just need to kind of loosen up all these rules that have been known as rules that we should set for our dog. And one of the things I tell everyone is that dogs are very, very equivalent to toddlers in how they think, how they are cognitively and emotionally. And if we loosen up this rein, so to speak, and start working with them with that in mind, it makes life so much easier.
Not everything's a thing.
Mm-hmm. We have a number of clients that call us the granola place.
Isn't it nice, Don?
Well, and it's more about nutrition with us than other stuff. But we wear that as a badge of honor. And I mean, that's really, and you know, people know what, people are seeking us out because of the way we do things. And there are other people in the area that do things differently. Mm-hmm. You know, I wish they would get beyond that, but they don't. I see you, Beth. I'll get to you next.
Okay.
And you know, but we've been doing it long enough that they come to us specifically looking for that. And I think for those of you that are listening that are building a business, I'm just going to throw this out there. Also recognize that you may not get every client who comes to you, mm-hmm. every prospective client.
And you don't want every client.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. That's an okay thing. Because there are some of them you may want, you're going to get, or may not want, and you're going to get the ones that fit. Beth.
So, you know, I know a lot of people in the dog behavior world are still working very hard to disconnect people from the Bill Keeler concept, Caesar Milan concept of dog training. And in the cat world, it's very different. What we're trying to live down is this idea of cats are all jerks and think you're their servants. You can't actually teach them to do anything. The whole idea of hiring a cat behavior person is ridiculous. I have had plenty of people say, my mom says I'm throwing away my money when they hire me, you know, because just the idea of training cats is ridiculous. They can't be trained. They're completely independent. They're jerks anyway. Think about all the cats in Disney movies. They're jerks. They're the bad characters. And they can't be trained. And so we're working with a very, you know, you guys are working from a baseline of force training. We're working from a baseline of cats can't be trained.
Mm.
And so it's a very different problem.
It is harder, though. It is harder because you have to think differently about what you're doing with a cat.
Yes. And, you know, training cats is not harder. It's just different. They have different motivations. And so it's not harder. It's just different. But what's interesting is, I mean, we say this all the time. When I get together with other cat behavior professionals, we say, typically when I see a client, it takes me 20 minutes to figure out what's up with the cat. And an hour and a half to figure out what's up with the people, because it's really about convincing the people that their cat's behavior can be changed and motivating them to make changes. That's the hard part. It's very rare, and it certainly happens, but it's very rare that I have a hard time figuring out what's up with the cat.
You know, it gets to another core issue here, or not core issue, but core fact. No matter what species we're talking about, if you're meeting their needs, and you understand what their normal behaviors are,
yeah.
and how they communicate,
you're fine.
You're fine. If you don't know those things, then you probably shouldn't be in this business. And the hard part sometimes is communicating the importance of that stuff
right.
to our human clients, the ones who have the credit card or the checkbook or whatever, and getting them to understand that those things are essential. And when you've got a lot of noise in the world right now, much of it social media, yeah, of other people saying, no, you still got to be the alpha and all that, it is noise you have to work against. I mean, that's definitely still out there, but I think, you know, we've made some real progress. There's more progress to be made, but it's a much better world than it was 28 years ago.
What we have on social media for cats, and this is horrifying, it's horrifying, of people showing videos of their cats being terrified and abused. And the video is, look at this psycho cat, or isn't this funny? Or look at this cat's reaction. And I'm looking at it and it's like, oh my God, I need to call the police. You know, this is horrifying me, what I'm seeing.
We hate
and that.
That
is really common.
We see that with dogs too, right? You know, it was people come home, what did you do? What did you do? Look how guilty.
Well, the whole dog shaming thing, yes, or the other end. I use this in my puppy classes. I show them a video on YouTube of a young father with an infant chasing this big German Shepherd around, trying to put him on the back of the German Shepherd. And the guy's just laughing hilariously. The Shepherd is giving every sign in the world that, you know, get me out of here. This is not fair. And I tell my students, all you have to do is type in on YouTube, child riding on dog. You can find hundreds of things like that, and people are posting that and proud of it. But I show that, and then I compare it to an image of a lithograph I found from the early 1900s on Google. And it shows these kids riding a dog. But then if you read the text underneath, it talks about, this is the stone dog, the statue somewhere. And you can get out of that. They knew back then they could do that with the statue, but they could never do it with a living, breathing dog. And I say, that's what we need to be thinking about. They understood it back then. What's happened to the world? Kim?
You know, something that you used to describe yourself, Dawn, in the very beginning today was a teacher of people. And I think when it comes to educating people, we have to be very careful as professionals to not shame the human with either what they don't know or what, you know, cultural biases they may have, or if they've watched The Dog Whisperer for, you know, every season, you know, and they use words like alpha or dominant or what have you. And it can be very easy, especially if someone is a new trainer or new behavior consultant, to really jump on every opportunity, you know, to educate the person as you're having a 2-hour, you know, behavior consult with them. And I find sometimes it's better to just let some of those things go. And like to use Sandra's example of showing them is often better than sitting there explaining everything to them and telling them how everything that they know is wrong, and that they're not meeting any of their dog's needs, and they don't understand the breed that they have in their house, that they have a Ferrari and they're really a Toyota Camry kind of family. And,
that's,
you know,
my thing.
Yeah, we can get into this very deflating conversation with our clients, and then it doesn't serve them, and it certainly doesn't serve their pet.
I think one of the things that I really like the way Judy talks about your dog's equivalent to a human toddler. Mm-hmm. And I think that's a great way to introduce this to people and getting them to understand, you know, what's acceptable and what's not. Because go ahead, Judy, you can describe it better, but most people really get that at that point.
And just, you know, just a real quick example, I can't tell you how many clients I've been to their homes and they're pulling their hair out, and I make that one statement and you just see, oh, thank goodness. And then they'll message me later and say, that one sentence about dogs being like toddlers has given me a whole new outlook and life is easier now.
So you just give them permission, you know.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So we've got a Facebook comment.
Muted.
here, I want to share, and then we'll get Sam. But this is from one of our listeners here. The best thing I've done for my business recently is to learn more about human behavior, which gets me back to something one of you said somewhere along the way, and I don't remember who it was. But oftentimes what we have to teach these people is that they have to change their behavior before they can change the pet's behavior. And that's really critical too. Sam, if you had something, go ahead.
Judy, you know, when you're saying that, you know, especially when you talk to clients who have had children, whatever else, work kids, you know, whatever, you know, parents pick their battles, right?
Mm-hmm.
They pick their battles of what's the most important thing, and everything else will kind of find its way.
Yeah.
The other thing too is, and I think we need to help young trainers, young behavior consultants, whatever species they're working with, we have to teach them about human body language.
Yes.
All right. Because a lot of times they're not paying attention to the cues that the humans that they're trying to help are giving them. And so things are going over their head, or you see that those defensive postures, those deer in the headlight postures, you know, whatever else is going on. And if you're not picking up on that, whatever message you're trying to teach, whatever you're trying to do, is lost. Right. And
totally agree.
The best teachers are good listeners.
Mm-hmm.
Give your clients a chance to talk, get their point of view. Better fact, when everyone is there for a consult, everybody in the family, no matter their ages, ask everybody their point of view, what they're seeing, what they're feeling, how they're reacting, et cetera. So that you get a really good idea instead of just from one adult or two adults' viewpoints, right? Kids see things so much differently than us.
And so much better.
Brutally honest. Yeah.
And they will tell you things sometimes mom and dad won't. I've had that same experience. It's very helpful. Judy, you were going to say something.
And you know, Sam's talking about, and I say it all the time, pick your battles, right? And so one example, I like to give them human examples because people tend to relate to that easily. And what I tell people is, I've been married to my husband for 30 years. The first time he did laundry, he packed all of his black and white things in the washer at the same time. For 30 years, I've said, Kevin, do your blacks and do your whites. He might do two loads of black and whites combined, right? But after 30 years, I've been like, you know, I'm picking my battles. As long as my stuff isn't in there, I don't care. And if all of his stuff looks gray and dingy, I don't care.
Yeah.
So just like our dog.
Judy, I think we could talk for a whole hour about men doing laundry.
Husband.
Sorry, Don. Sorry, Sam.
But you know, here's the thing. Is it really that important? You know, and I think we need to often talk to our clients and say, is it really that important? But something else I want to hop in with real quick here. On Facebook, you know, I'm on a Border Collie list, and not a day goes by where somebody doesn't say something like, my dog's chewing on the carpet, or all of a sudden my dog is doing whatever. And people are jumping out there with advice and how to fix those concerns. And my thing is, we need to find out what is causing the concern before we start try to fix it. And I'm seeing a rash of that. And that's something for new trainers who come in and they're really excited because they know some protocols. And so they jump into working on those protocols without truly understanding what the problem is.
Medical before behavioral sometimes too.
Absolutely. Yeah.
Sudden change, dramatic change, pain, discomfort affects behavior. Right. Let's face it.
Right. A long, long time ago, I went to a conference where Susan Friedman was giving a talk, and she said something that I use in my clients all the time because it's funny, and so everybody remembers it, which is that when you see a behavior, the first thing you have to ask is WTF, which stands for what's the function?
Yep.
And when I say that, everybody
excellent.
Laughs, but then they remember it. They never forget it.
Yeah.
That's great, Beth.
One of the things that I do, going back to the sit thing, because I think sit is the most overrated thing that we ask the dog. So it's like to sit or not to sit, you know, that's the question. And I ask the clients, they're like, oh, she's not sitting. Why? why is she not sitting? How come she's sitting inside and she's not sitting outside? How come she's sitting for you and she's not sitting for me? Why? So one of the things that I do, I said, let's change it to watch, do a watch. If the dog offers you a sit when you do a watch, which is the natural thing to do, the dog is comfortable. If the dog does not offer you a sit when you ask the dog to watch, the dog is not comfortable. And may this be the worst thing that ever happens to us, that the dog doesn't sit when we ask her to sit. But now you have a cue. Now you have a thing that you can say, okay, what is making the dog uncomfortable? How come the dog is not offering you a sit right now?
You know, I think doing things so that the client or student remembers it is really, really important. And Beth, you gave a good example there. I collect dog and cat cartoons. So stuff that comes up in my Facebook stream, and I go to some specific sites and I save them if I think it's going to be useful in training. And I use them in my online presentations because I really do think they put things in a way that people are more likely Yep. to remember stuff. And I use some movie clips too. Like, I don't even remember the movie, but the line in it is, what we've got here is a failure to communicate.
Yes, it's the Cool Hand Luke.
Cool Hand Luke, there we go. Yes. And that's how I introduce my section on body language. And I really think it does help people remember more, and little tricks like that are really good. I want to share a couple of things from our listeners. There's a book from Stacy recommends How to Talk So Kids Will Listen and Listen So Kids Will Talk. And
Ingrid,
90% of what we do is actually teaching owners about canine behavior and body language. Watching the owner can tell us more about the dog. You know, I think that's a big part of it, but you know, if you were to look at all of the dog training classes in your area, how many of them are talking about behavior and how many of them are talking about body language? I know in my area, it's a one digit number, less than five.
If so. And dog trainers that come into the house, no, you don't see it.
Yeah, it is sorely lacking. And I think that's something that's really important. Judy.
Hey, Don, another thing that I ask people when they are so concerned that their dog won't sit, for instance, I ask them, why does the dog need to sit? Why does your dog need to sit? Right. And they're either going to say, I don't know, or they're going to say something like, so he doesn't jump on people. And then my question is, well, why is he jumping on people?
Exactly.
And so, you know, I think we need to help people understand what's important and what isn't. And that can be kind of tough after many, many years of everyone thinking the most important thing for a dog to do is sitting down.
Yeah, no, so. Exactly.
Yeah. Real quick from one of our listeners, Ingrid Quignorris, what a great thing. For many humans, changing behavior takes a change in belief.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
that's what I was pointing out too. Right. And just what Judy said, you know, why is it important to sit? And then, you know, I was in a house 2 weeks ago of a senior dog who has pain issues. And the woman was like, sit. And I, don't do that. It probably hurts to sit. And like Judy just said, why does anybody have to sit? Judy, sit. Why?
Yeah. Why?
You know?
I tell them it's like going into someone's house and they're like, sit down. Yeah, sit down. I don't want to sit down.
And that's exactly it too. And it's not even said once. It's said like, you know, 20 times.
20 times.
Especially when there's a trigger passing by.
There's always a compromise. If the dog is jumping up on people and you don't want him to jump up on people, there's always a compromise. There's a way that you can get the dog not to jump up on people that doesn't involve the dog performing an alternate behavior that he doesn't want to perform.
It's always
a compromise.
And then you're adding so much stress, right, Beth? Because if you're trying to get them to do something they don't want to do, now the dog is more anxious and going to jump more.
The problem is there's still this inherent belief in many people, I feel, that 100% obedience is required and that doesn't include compromise. And I think that's the thing. We all know it. And I'm going to guess most of our clients know that's not the way the world is. But if we look at people that are still looking for dog trainers and obedience is kind of tied into the definition, you know, that's still a thing. And so maybe that's something we all need to be thinking about as a whole of how do we move away from that?
What's that quote? Obedience will not fix a behavior. I don't remember what the, quote is, but yeah, but basically
will not,
obedience
will not
is
change
not
the
change.
way you're feeling or something like that. I know which one you mean.
Most trainers, they are so focused on the consequence. Let's fix the consequence, you know, and we are more into the cause, you know, why? I'm always asking why. Let's fix, let's work on the cause and then the consequence plays along, you know.
Right.
And at this note, I want to thank everybody who's listening and who's participating. I do need to wrap us up by 1 o'clock today. I have very strict instructions on that for a good reason. So I want to highlight, and we kind of stepped into this today. Our next topic is, the screen just moved on me. Hold on. Our
changing
next
a pet's
topic
behavior.
Changing a pet's behavior by changing human behavior, February 21st. And we hope you guys will be, that are listening, will be back for that.
Yeah.
And thank you everyone so much. It's been
a good
week.
And thank you.
We will see you in another month. Bye-bye.
Bye.
Bye.
Stay warm.
I'm going to the beach.